Дамы и господа, давайте начинать.
Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, let's start because our first speaker is already here. And it's my pleasure to give the floor to Dr. Botsaroba from the Russian Academy of Sciences. Thank you, distinguished Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to say a few words on what Russia has been doing and what Russia could do to reach peaceful settlement in Sudan. I will also say a few words about the Russian-Sudanese relationship because our first contacts between the two countries date back to middle of the 19th century. But let us talk about these days. Because now this is one of our priorities in the Russian foreign policy. We participate in peaceful process both in the context of two-party negotiations and in other ways. In 1990s, we also were advocating the necessity to maintain the territorial integrity of Sudan, whatever future developments were. And we stick to this position today as well, as it follows from the statements of representatives of the Foreign Ministry of Russia, which say that Russia is for settlement of all the conflict and issues by negotiations and proceeds from the basic principle of territorial integrity and sovereignty of Sudan. This joint commission was set up with 163 persons, including 19 policemen and other members. And for worse, the top priority is to stop the bloodshed in this region. We supported the statement which was made on May 30, 2007 in Potsdam by the GA chairman group. The statement was an important one. The thing is that it contained an appeal to the Sudanese government to allow deployment of the Hydra mission. And at that moment, the Sudanese government agreed to the deployment of a UN hybrid mission. And in November 2007, the UN Security Council approved a resolution on the hybrid operation in Darfur. Naturally, future developments in Sudan will very much depend on the relations between the south and the north of the country, because we wouldn't like to see again the civil war of 1990s with lots of casualties, where lots of money was spent on the war, and both the southerners and the northerners do realize that such a development of situation in the country would be very dangerous. And this is proved by their agreement on the Abyei problem, because when both parties agreed that this conflict should be referred to the International Arbitration Court, when the decision was made, it wasn't in favor of the southern regions. The borders were changed, and the oil fields were outside these boundaries, and it meant that the south of Sudan would have no oil deposits. But the southerners agreed with the decision of the International Court of Arbitration. Of course, we cannot say that everything has been completely settled with respect to Abyei, conflict. What has to be done for this problem not to aggravate? Of course, first of all, the demilitarization of Abyei should be carried out in line with the provisions of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And it would be good that the parties exploiting the crude oil deposits could share somehow the profit. And if we speak about international efforts on settling the Sudanese conflict, we see that no one can solve this problem alone. Egypt, Libya, Qatar, European countries, Americas cannot do anything if they act alone. We need to act jointly. But in the political sphere, now the most important step to come soon is the presidential and parliamentary election of April 2010. We need to ensure full transparency of these elections so that the defeated party could not claim that the election results were counterfeited. And to ensure that the elections are true and fair, we need to have as many international observers as possible, plus carrying out the democratic procedures and reforms. We are not there to impose our rules of the game to Sudan, the rules which are okay for Europe, but not for Sudan. It can generate chaos in Sudan. That's why we have to be very, very cautious. Now let's talk about Darfur. The problem is that UNAMID did not have the necessary amount of workers that was provided for 26,000 people. The worst thing was that the number of helicopters was insufficient. Instead of 24 helicopters to be deployed, we have just received 5 helicopters from Ethiopia. Probably it makes sense to send a couple of Russian-made helicopters to the hybrid forces. It's not that technically complicated, because we already have a helicopter pilot group of support who is part of our Russian mission to Sudan. Our crew is very experienced with servicing Mi-type helicopters, and our helicopters are very much compatible with the helicopters to be used there. One more problem, displaced persons. And in this respect, it seems to me that we have to shift accent from pure humanitarian aid to creating jobs and setting up social infrastructure, on the condition that such an assistance is justified also by special subsidies from Khartoum, Juba, and a number of states with respect to territorial integrity of the country. Because if the country disintegrates, can you imagine what will happen there? If separatists in Sudan win, the separatists in the south of Africa, in the Great Lakes and elsewhere will have a very strong impetus to continue their struggle. For the time being, you can see 1972-1973, Anya leadership got the key positions in the government of the south of Sudan and also in the leadership of Sudanese Socialist Union. Into 1991, the Council of Leadership of the National Salvation Army suggested that Sudan should become a federative state, the Southerners said, no, we don't want this, then there will be no more single country. And now, probably, there is such a chance. But the question is whether the South will be able to be economically independent now, considering that it has no more oil reserves. And the decisions of the international court are not restricted to only these decisions. We are doing more than that. And let me remind to you that last year, the Sudanese supported Russia's military operation in the south of Ossetia. We have very good collaboration between the ministries of internal affairs. We are rendering minor economic humanitarian assistance. We are establishing stronger ties with the south of Sudan. But it is also clear that these ties, these relationships will be a success if there is peace in Sudan. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Mohamed Makhjoub Haroon, the Future Trends Fund Director. You know, it seems that the after-lunch relaxation and coffee break were beneficial for everybody, so I suggest we could add vodka to the feast. Then it would be easier for us to discuss the problems. Now, of course, I'm just kidding, and I would like to thank our chairman. And I'd like to thank the Institute of Modern Development, the organizers of this conference, the ones that made this conference possible. And I would like to wish any success to our practical conference, considering that here we have professionals, experts in international problems and African problems. Last year, for instance, I participated in the first conference, which was held in China or organized by China. It was a conference on Darfur problems. And I am now in Moscow discussing just the same issues. And I'm very happy that our friends in the East, I mean China and other friends, are already here, including Russia, and that they are paying such attention to the Sudanese issues. And I think that such a combination of Western and Eastern experience will help us find a way out of the problem and ensure a comprehensive, peaceful settlement in Sudan. Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a comment on the way the world sees the situation in Sudan. You often see that Sudan is getting a negative coverage. This is sort of a pattern, of an existent pattern or stereotype with respect to Sudan. We always see in the mass media or other publications and scientific journals, etc., we see that Sudan is featured in a classical way, in a rather negative way, of course, And here, various security services are probably to blame, because some countries think that in Sudan the population is in real misery, that it's a complete catastrophe. At the same time, I heard a number of remarks made by a number of speakers today who said that the situation in Sudan shouldn't be considered as bad as it is featured by mass media, for instance. And some speakers said that there are some first signs of improvement of the situation, because Sudan is, first of all, the land of hope. You shouldn't paint it all in black. It's not just black and white. Many people are interested in the situation in Sudan. The question is where they are getting their information. And the question is, on the other hand, how do they analyze this information based on the data you have? And the data, too, is not always accurate. This means that we need to pay more attention on ensuring that you are getting the truth, you are learning the truth, and we need to prioritize those who are really involved in this. If this happens, then I'm sure the situation will change and Sudan will be perceived completely differently. I would like to invite you to think about this. I'd like you to come to Sudan if you have an opportunity and take a look at the situation in Sudan, rather than simply read about the catastrophe in Sudan in mass media or listen to politicians. And therefore, I would like to say a few more words. First of all, speaking about the political aspect of this thing, because some of you probably know more about the political aspect of the problem. It is true that there is a certain progress. There is a progress in terms of democratization of the society, as it was already mentioned. I think this is a very important process, because Sudan for the first time over the past two decades has been saying that it has to get ready for the elections. People will come to the voting stations, which is a sign of democracy, of mature democracy. This is written in the constitution, and the people of Sudan will be able to participate in this. A number of important steps have already been taken, such as adoption of the election law. For instance, a People's Commissariat for the elections issues has been set up. Similar committees or commissariats, as we call them, have been set up elsewhere. They are preparing for the negotiations. There is a center in Khartoum, which means that the internal political life has become much more viable, and at the same time the opinion of opposition also has to be considered. At the end of October 2009 in Juba, they are going to reconvene to discuss their common standpoint. So on the one hand, we see that the political life changes, and there are many of those who are ready to participate in the election. We would like everybody to very closely follow the process of election. Therefore, we would like to see this election when announced. We would like to see the quorum at the election. We are interested to see these elections free and open, in line with democracy standards, allowing people to express their will and their opinion. And my second thing I would like to mention It's about the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. As you all know, it was signed 4 years ago, and of course it has to be implemented with participation of all the representatives of the country and representatives of other stakeholders, and we are sure that signing of this agreement is a very positive fact. And this means that we have to insist that we objectively that objectively all the provisions of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement are implemented, and therefore we see that the parties to the agreement they have certain problems, but the main thing is to implement the major principles, the major provisions, because the choice is whether we will stay as an integral parts of a whole Sudan or we split into two countries. Of course, I'm not interested to see this happen. I mean, I'm not a champion of cessation, but some people say that in this case, this situation may result in war. I don't think in the north and in the south anybody would be interested to unleash a war. But what I am afraid is that what we currently see, various tribal conflicts in the south of the country, for instance, these conflicts can turn into an eternal war if there is an independent state set up in the market. Independent from this government. In the south, it will only be the head of the iceberg hitting some deep processes which can very much worsen the situation in the near future, and we will enjoy the consequences for quite a long time. And all this will negatively influence our situation in the country on the whole. Of course, our relationship and our responsibility is our joint work is focused on settling Sudan's problem by peaceful arrangements. Can you give me one more minute, please? Two more things to go and that's it. I understand that here we have representatives of different political wings and political schools, but I think that what was discussed in Doha, Qatar, this is not the ideal variant, but nevertheless, this is the only positive result we can find. There is no alternative for Doha. Even though it seems an ideal way for collaboration, but we have to stick to this way. And secondly, of course, political regulation is a very important thing. We have to strive for it, remembering Darfur's problem. But even more than ever, we have to find the roots or the reasons of what's going on in Darfur, eradicate these reasons. We need to develop a new Marshall Plan, if you want, for Darfur. And then we will have some first hope to reach a peace settlement in Darfur. Let me tell you, those who are interested in political regulation, they are interested in giving us any assistance to find a good decision in order to prevent any conflicts and crisis. And now about the International Criminal Court. I listened to the speakers today and I was told already that the benefits are the same, and in case with Darfur, we can see that justice should first be regarded as the world. No one can act against the fairness, because we advocate fairness. And the third principle is that the one who is white and just, he always arrives at his goal, he always meets his objectives. And this is exactly what we are trying to do. And I very much hope that in the light of the organizational changes in the country, we set up relevant commissions and committees for investigation. And therefore, I'm saying that responsibility is of top importance, and we are very much interested to build a better future for ourselves and our younger generation. And Russia having a big resource will be able to play a big role in the development of the whole of Russia, as well as the whole region. And we will see that in future we can do anything if we join our efforts. Because we need to turn Sudan into a country which is respected all over the world, which is accepted all over the world, and a reputable country, independently of the problems we currently face, and the problems which I hope, which everybody is sure, will be settled in the nearest future. I hope that the future of Sudan seems optimistic. I'm sure we will achieve it. Now I would like to give floor to Mr. Akol, ex-Minister of Foreign Affairs of Sudan. Спасибо, господин.
MP Margelov, the special envoy on Sudan, for organizing this meeting and for inviting us to attend, and also for us to participate. And through him, I thank the government and people of Russia for the hospitality that has been according to us since we came to this beautiful city, Moscow. I had prepared a document which I wanted to present, but in view of the discussion that has been going on this morning, I thought that instead of being too specialized, I should talk in general terms and leave the paper for tomorrow in the panel discussion. And again, also, even on these general comments, I wanted also to concentrate more instead of getting divided. The time will not allow me to comment adequately on a number of issues. So I chose one, and that is the implementation of the CPA. It is agreed by all that the CPA is the most important achievement in the history of Sudan. The president himself, during the signature, described it as a rebirth of the Sudan independence. So this indicates how important it was. And therefore, the implementation of the CPA is the salvation of Sudan. But we need to remind ourselves that the CPA was basically to stop the war in the South that has raged for two decades. And it was meant to achieve, among other things, two very vital matters. That is peace and stability as one, and then development dividends. The implementation of the CPA has gone a long way. Again, only those demagogues who really dispute that there has been tremendous achievements in the implementation of the CPA. But also, some important provisions are running behind the schedule. And both parties to the agreement bear responsibility in one way or the other for the delay. A number of observations are important if the CPA is to go on track and achieve the desired objectives. One is that the CPA itself is predicated on a partnership between the National Congress and the SPLM. And there can never be a smooth implementation of the CPA without that partnership. This is what the CPA says. Additionally, the international community has also pledged to present or to provide to the parties financial and political support needed for the implementation of the CPA. So it is a partnership between the partners and the international community. Unfortunately, one party to the CPA prefers to deal with the opposition, which does not support the CPA in the first place, instead of engaging its partner. Secondly, the same party to the agreement abandoned its responsibilities in the central government, where major decisions on the country are taken. I've heard people talk about Khartoum and Juba this morning, but I humbly say that there is no tale of two cities here. Our late leader, Dr. John Garang, said the government is one. There is no government of Bashir in Khartoum and the government of John Garang in Juba. There's only one government for Bashir and Garang in Khartoum. So Khartoum is the center for all the decisions in the country. And that is why the Southerners have fought hard to achieve the position of the first vice president. So that in that position, the South can influence the decisions that are made regarding the country, especially the CPA. That office now is vacant by choice of the occupant and to the detriment of the CPA. I believe that most of the problems now that are confronted by the CPA is that there is no first vice president in Khartoum that engages the president on the issues as they arise. Point number five is that a lot is being said about the failure to implement some aspects of the CPA on time. Most of what is being said is true. For instance, the border demarcation and the enactment of some laws, especially the Referendum Act, are running behind schedule. However, nothing is being said about the failure of the government of Southern Sudan to fulfill the very two central issues that I have mentioned. That is peace and stability, and then development dividends. Nobody talks about that. Nobody also talks about the refusal of the government of Southern Sudan to provide a democratic space for all the political parties in the country to be active in the South. Nobody also talks about the lack of respect for human rights in Southern Sudan, because the rule of law is not being implemented. How can there be a democratic transformation in the country when political parties in the South are denied the right to operate and the rule of law is flouted? You can never divide democracy. You can never divide the human rights. These are universal concepts and they must be applicable to all. Otherwise, we fail to stand by our commitments. Some apologies for the government of Southern Sudan. Reason that the government of Southern Sudan started from scratch. Nothing could be further from the truth. By way of comparison, the High Executive Council, which was the government in southern Sudan after the Addis Ababa Peace Agreement in 1972, it started with one car and one office for 12 ministers. That is a real scratch. Now, that government only in 2 years were able to achieve a lot and to be viable, despite the fact that it didn't have the resources that the government of Southern Sudan now has. By comparison, the government of Southern Sudan inherited government buildings in Juba, which only needed some renovation. It inherited working governments in the 10 states of Southern Sudan. It's also inherited well-qualified Southern Sudanese in virtually all the fields of human endeavor who were ready to run an efficient civil service in Southern Sudan. Unhappily, lack of planning and rampant corruption were and still are the obstacles against having good governance in Southern Sudan. We need to help the government of Southern Sudan in these respects, rather than hiding our heads in the sand and pretend that everything is going on well. This is doing disservice to the CPA. Also, some countries in the international community have failed not only to fulfill their Oslo commitments, but even to be seen as impartial brokers in the CPA implementation. Again, we need to correct that so that we can help the process. The conduct of the elections in 2010 is a must. It is a requirement of the CPA and is the only means to bring about democratic transformation in the country. I heard this morning or this afternoon somebody saying that the referendum is the only non-negotiable provision of the CPA. I think all the provisions of the CPA have equal importance. And I think the elections are really an important prelude to the referendum, because you need a referendum. For a referendum, you need a democratic atmosphere for it to be viable and really reflective of the view of those who are being asked to vote. Elections is equally important as the referendum itself. But in our experience in the last 2 years, we have seen many forces that are bent on using every excuse to scuttle the elections process. We must be watchful of these and expose them, because any delay in the timetable that has been set by the Election Commission, with the election process ending in April 2010, as has been pointed out before, will definitely mean there can be no election before January 2011, which is the time for the referendum. As you know, there is a rainy season that goes for 6 months in Southern Sudan. So if you miss April, then you will go to 2011. This should not be allowed to take place. Also, a lot needs to be done in preparation for 2011 referendum, and I have talked about this in the paper that I had prepared. I hope by tomorrow we'll have time to discuss it in the panel discussion. I will end by reminding ourselves that the success or failure of the CPA will be in the South. After all, the CPA was mainly about the South. So if we ignore what is happening in southern Sudan and think that the CPA can go ahead without that, we'll be making a big mistake and we'll be missing the central issue and we'll be mistaking the wood for the forest. I end here, Mr. Chairman, and I thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you. Пожалуйста, господин Ат-Таиб.
Thank you. And now I would like to give floor to Director of Future Trends Fund, Atiya Al-Taib.
In tone between speaking in Arabic or speaking in English or not speaking
at all
or just concentrating on one element or two, and it seems that that's what I'm going to do. Mr. Chairman, the two things I'm going to say first should not be counted among the 10 minutes I'm going to speak in. One is telling the people about myself, and this is very short. I'm the director of the Peace Research Institute of the University of Khartoum. I consider myself an active member of the Sudanese civil society because I belong to the university. And I have long experience in African conflicts all around the place for a long time. And it ended up by me being chosen to work on the Sudanese conflict. And I think that's the best kind of end I have for my career, because it seems that we are going to have peace in Sudan sooner than I thought. So I'm an optimist. Second thing, I lead an institute, the Peace Research Institute. I've seen most of the people who spoke here inside Sudan and outside Sudan. We are a very active institute. We do many things in both important tracks of democratization in Sudan and peace building. And we are the ones who are doing most of the work within and among the Darfurian civil society and issues relating to Darfur. That's finished. Now I start my...
You must pay for this commercial.
I will concentrate on the future. I think you heard a lot about the past and the analysis and kind of. And luckily, I noticed that there is a lot of this time, and I've been around and attended many conferences on Darfur and on peace in Sudan and democracy in Sudan all over the world. This is the one conference where I found that more and more we are moving towards a kind of positive consensus towards what to do about Sudan. Before I continue, I must repeat what the other said about really thanking and congratulating the Institute of Modern Development and the Russian Federation and His Excellency the Special Envoy for holding this conference at this opportune moment. This is a very important moment in time. And I reiterate also what some of the friends here said about hopefully this conference will be repeated again. Not in a year's time, I suggest in 6 months' time, so that we'll be able to see what happened in the at the end of the preparatory phase for the Darfurian peace process, the elections and referendum, and see what is needed, and try to come up with ideas and provision for to complement the processes in Sudan. And then to hold another conference within another 6 months. And within the coming year, two conferences. I don't know if they all will be, all of them will be in Moscow, or maybe we choose another venue or something. But I do hope the international community represented in the international envoys and some of the experts form a sort of a structure which will oversee this. Yani more and more we bring ourselves together for an activity pertaining to monitoring and evaluating the two processes in Sudan and helping. Because I know, I've been in Sudan for a long time now, all my life. And I know that Sudanese problems will not be solved but by the Sudanese themselves. It will be very difficult for anybody to impose through sanctions or what have you, or even if this government is changed or if it continued or whatever, nobody will be able to impose anything on the Sudanese. And it's the most diverse country, most stubborn people, I know them. I have my sons in my house. You'll be very, it's impossible to impose things on those people. Let it be a Sudanese process, and it will be a Sudanese, let us support the Sudanese process towards the kind of universal objectives for which we all work. Now let me be more precise on the future. And let us start by this house. There is a lot to be said about what's happening in this house now. And we have concentrated for too long on the formal upper limit levels of dealing with the problems of the South. Let us see it in totality and within the global Sudan. Sudan is in a crisis. Nobody in government or where will tell you that. I tell you that. The country is in a crisis, a global crisis, which requires a global way, holistic way, to look into the problems of Sudan. What's happening in the South is part of that problem. What's happening in Darfur is part of that problem. What's happening to the Central Sudan political process is part of that problem. So if we think that we can look at the South in an isolated manner and try to look at it as a case which we can cure without considering the totality of Sudan, that will be doomed to failure. And if we take any of the issues singularly, we will see that those issues are first national, second, they relate to this house. The elections, the two referenda, and what have you, because there are other issues about which apparently we are not talking here. If you want to deal with this house, we must be frank with ourselves and first frank with SPLM. Most of this house, and I tell you, I know, يعني استغفر الله من said I يعني لكن I think I'm fairly informed about what's happening in the South up to yesterday. Certain parts of southern Sudan are in a process of destabilization. There is violence in the South. Most of us mistakenly are talking about it as tribal violence. Its manifestation is in the tribal form. But as a matter of fact, it's quasi-political and in its way to change itself to political problems in southern Sudan. It started by Upper Nile. And I'm one of the people who think that Equatoria is on a volcano, time bomb. If anything happened, the sort of thing I expect happened in Equatoria, then we are going to have violence all over Equatoria. And all of us, we worked in those areas at certain times, we know that the formations are there. The arms are there, the reasons are there. What's happening in Northwest and Bahr al-Ghazal, the explanations people gave to me did not convince me. What's happening in Bahr al-Ghazal, I don't know. I don't know. But it's not as secure a place as many people think. SPLM, with the help of the North, the national government and the international community should take a look back and try to find out for us and for itself a cure for the growing violence and instability which we are seeing in this house now. So we cannot talk in a rational way about elections or referenda without really being knowing and understanding what's happening in this house on the security level and on other levels. I am one of the five people whom SPLM invited to Juba to facilitate the debate between SPLM and the eight southern political parties. And I tell you, as Dr. Lam, my friend, said, that there is no political process in the South. There is a real problem in this area. It's a one-party rule. I told them that they didn't like it, but usually I tell people things which they don't like in government and everywhere. That's a one-party rule. And I don't know about my friends, but I couldn't see a real democratization process in this house, the friends of SPLM must tell them that, because in that way we'll have more violence. And now let me tell you something. This must be a heavenly design, as I told my friends a minute ago, that all these very difficult and sensitive processes happen at one and the same time in Sudan. We are going through difficult times, and we are facing difficult problems in the north and in the south at one and the same time. We don't have capacities for that. We need help for that. The south definitely need help more than the north to really start a credible democratization process, which will bring the other political groups in the south together to the level which will allow them to contest the elections and the referendum. People who know the south know already that these are very difficult processes for the south, for obvious reasons. And the north knows more than the south, because it is the responsibility of the northerners that the south, in the state of underdevelopment, it finds itself in now. Yes, it was the colonialist for some time, but then it was the national governments who are responsible for the underdevelopment which we see in the south now. I tell you, because only recently the plane got down, landed with me and my group in El Bibor, just to carry someone who had malaria to Juba. And I felt bad, sick for 3 days for what I saw in El Bibor village. The degree of underdevelopment in a matter of half an hour I saw in front of me. So the SPLM and the Southern government need help, and people must help them prioritize. And they must put it right so that they will be able to deal with the very difficult problems they are facing. There is an element of capacity, there is an element of mismanagement, there is an element of violence. And we in the north are just putting our hands like this and watching. In the 1 minute, I will move immediately to Darfur, where we are, I think, one of the few organizations which are doing a lot of work in Darfur. We are doing a lot of work in Darfur. We are working with the Darfuri people to try to redefine, to activate, and to bring product out of what we are doing for the talks with the civil society groups in Darfur. Weak civil society, divided civil society, working in a bad situation where ethnicity reigns, violence reigns, geographical problems, environmental problems, political problems, and all out of all this, we need to gather a group which might be to a degree representative to the Darfuri people. We are doing a lot of work in collaboration with local Sudanese civil society organizations and with international civil society organizations and academic organizations like the Max Planck Institute in Heidelberg in Germany. We have a big program supporting the Darfurians to bring in especially people from the diaspora. The process needs help. The peace process, which will end up in Doha, needs a lot of work. It must draw from the Nifasha experience. There is a problem of capacity. There must be capacity support for the negotiators, both from the north and south. And this can be done in different ways. We must restructure the whole scene so that the stakeholders in the Darfurian problem must be organized. And we must build a structure called Friends of Darfur or whatever for those different countries who have a finger in Darfur somewhere or other. Those include the US, Libya, Chad, Egypt, Qatar, and it's a long list. Eritrea, Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, and it's a very complicated thing. We must find a way so that those people sit together in some sort of a structure and agree that they are here to support the Darfuri peace and not to do anything behind the back of one another as they do now. So it will not be easy to continue the discussions, the dialogue, the negotiations in Doha without organizing the international stakeholders on the Darfur issue, capacity building for the negotiations, support for the sources and resources for information on Darfur. There is a lot of literature on Darfur about which many people don't know a thing. We must bring in from the international community support of an academic nature, of an informational nature, as we did in Nifasha. The best thing about Nifasha is that Nifasha was well organized, well structured, and it had all types of support. We cannot go to Doha just like that, huh? Send an email to someone and tell him that we expect you on the 26th of something to come to the negotiations. There must be preparatory work for Doha. The final thing is, let these processes take their time. Because the mistake we made in Abuja, and I was party to Abuja for a short time, was that we have to sign within 2 weeks. Huh? Then we have to sign within a week. Then we have to sign within 3 days. Huh? When someone asked me, a very important person in Abuja asked me, how much time do you think we need? I said, you need 6 months, because I've been talking to all these people at night, at least 6 months. He told me, bye-bye, if you are going tomorrow, really, just go back to Khartoum, because we are going to sign in 6 days' time. They did sign in 6 days' time, but only there was only one signatory. The rest left for many reasons. Those reasons we must study, look into, and benefit from the mistakes we committed in the past for the future. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Пожалуйста, господин Пол Мёрфи, директор европейских программ.
And now I would like to give floor to Mr. Paul Murphy, director of Safer World Foundation.
I'm representing an international organization, Safer World, that's dedicated to conflict prevention and community security building. We engage in Sudan, as in other African countries, increasingly supporting Africa-China dialogue. And Mr. Chairman, have worked in the recent past with departments from the Russian Foreign Ministry dedicated to arms and the international transfer of arms control. But personally, I have lived and later worked in Sudan since 1989. That was the year the current Khartoum government took power. Since my time is short, I plan to offer an important perspective to complement other remarks on the otherwise complex and critical situation facing the Sudanese people. It's a perspective shaped by having personally stood over the years under numerous meeting trees in Sudan, debating and listening to the testimony of countless ordinary citizens of their hopes and of their fears. In fact, to be personally exposed to what the precise human cost of the protracted war has had on its citizens is to terrify you when faced with even the smallest prospect that the current peace process would fail and a North-South war could possibly reignite again. So I'd like to emphasize the practical more than the scientific in relation to the CPA specifically. Sudanese leadership is facing challenges that are difficult for any individual to fully comprehend and absorb. There is much to speak of how we have got to this point already, but perhaps one of the most pressing observations, which really directed to international governance and peace actors, many represented at this conference, is that as the interim period rapidly counts down to its closing stages, there is diminishing space to exercise positive influence on the parties to reach a positive outcome from this fragile and some would say unraveling peace process. In the public domain, perceptions of the current international efforts do not appear to be in proportion to the intensity of the crisis being faced. In the firm belief that enduring solutions can only be Sudanese ones, it must also be appreciated that the nature and the design of the CPA and the deficit of mistrust that has sustained between the parties means international actors of good faith must also step up to the challenge in support of the Sudanese parties. We all know that the consequences of failure are likely to spread beyond Sudan's boundaries and could be with us for decades again. Again, against this backdrop of a mixed and often disappointing international response to the Sudanese peace agreements, it is absolutely imperative that over the remaining 14 months, there is consistency and clarity of purpose among governments and institutions over the spirit, standards, and limits of the CPA as the only means available to build a long-term transformative process. The CPA may be imperfect, and we can see its shortcomings more clearly day by day, but it is all that we have, and to weaken it further in any way is to meddle with Sudan's remaining hope of moving towards an agreeable arrangement of peaceful coexistence. But given the outrageous short time frame to get so much done, actors are inevitably going to be forced to adopt pragmatic positions. It's too late to turn the clock back. Following the dictates of the CPA, parties should have agreed ages ago on how the election and referendum process should proceed. And international engagement and active support too should have been more resolute and advanced. But it is also unacceptable to start trading some of the fundamental architecture of the agreement at this particular moment. As we've heard, there are many competing challenges, and one can't really be assessed in isolation from the other. In the context of the interim constitution, the proposed CPA blueprint for lasting peace was a linked triple jump, starting with the census and related issues of boundaries, moving to an election, and sealing the interim period with a southern referendum. Logical, but some might say overly optimistic, especially if the international witnesses and sponsors of the agreement believe this process would deliver on its own. However, insofar as we can say so, the most fundamental and perhaps also controversial element for a peaceful outcome is the promise the agreement gave to the southern peoples that they could express their right of self-determination through a plebiscite on where their political future should lie. Historically, it made this agreement framework stand out from other initiatives in the past. One could argue that without the promise of a referendum in the first place, it is doubtful that there would have been a CPA, or if so, that we'd have even got this far in the process. For Southerners, it was the necessary ingredient for accepting a peace arrangement that they, like so many others, had very little say or influence over. Indeed, for Northerners, it was perhaps an unsettling detail, but set in motion a fresh, albeit in-house debate within society about their future and political aspirations. Of course, the referendum must take place in a context within minimum safeguards and credibility. For many, the election is a critical part of the overall process and a key part of the CPA logic. Its inclusion gave a sense of reassurance for many skeptical citizens, especially those residing in the north, and intended to give legitimacy to the referendum process. But as time rapidly runs out, the lack of progress in establishing the conditions necessary for elections is deeply troubling. But assuming there will be progress in this regard, at this stage, sadly, we have to make an honest appraisal of what is possible within the time frame left. The election process may not turn out to be the significant benchmark in democracy that we'd like, but still a necessary rite of passage towards reaching a final peace arrangement. Expectations, therefore, need to be adjusted. However, this is not the case for the referendum. Anything other than a free, fair, and timely process around the referendum will seriously undermine the significant gains the parties have made under the CPA and make the return of war almost inevitable for another generation of Sudanese. I say this in the context of public perceptions in the south, but also for the peoples of South Kordofan and Blue Nile, who hold a similar hope for the promised public consultation under their protocol for peace. For these same pragmatic reasons, I believe we must prioritize, in terms of our expectations, the referendum over the election. In 2004, the Sudanese public, and especially Southerners, were exhausted with decades of war, but at the same time, we're reluctant to agree to a peace without some sense of having gained for years of struggle. Although relief from conflict was welcomed, there was skepticism, based on deep mistrust, over what the CPA could really offer in the long run. While there are compelling arguments as to why the referendum at this stage should be postponed or modified, in the mind of the majority of Southerners, it is sacrosanct. Understanding this psyche and point of view must be included in any political analysis that considers the options. While enjoying some benefits under the CPA, Southerners are overall disappointed and angry with the lack of dividends peace has brought over the past 4 years. However, that disappointment and the suffering being entrusted by host and returning populations is partially under check in the hope that the referendum will transpire. Without it, the already stressed southern environment, which is experiencing growing levels of insecurity, I think would unravel further. And today, a tense mood of uncertainty is intensifying over how, if at all, the referendum will take place. We see Sudanese, and indeed some internationals, offering or insisting on opposing arrangements. On the one hand, disagreeing on who should vote, where they should vote, what type of ballot it should be, who should monitor the process, what the percentage threshold will be for a result. And on the other hand, wanting to either delay or drop the referendum altogether. We see each side pushing the political limits of the other. I worry that the time, indeed the credibility, to ask Southerners to consider alternative options to secession is rapidly running out. We know the vast majority favour independence. That position may be rational, though we have to admit inadequate by not having the opportunity to really review the options of statehood and the consequences of those options. But the aspiration of making unity attractive is no longer taken seriously by the majority of Southerners, who talk with nervousness of a waning international interest in their peace and see disagreement amongst the parties to the agreement. Focusing on the referendum, I know, is not the only part of the picture, but if this element becomes in any way sacrificed in the political deadlock, the future is certainly grave. By drawing attention to the referendum now, we are also compelled to face up to the immense challenges beyond 2011. Whether it becomes a transition to independence or not, life beyond the CPA will need sensitive constitutional management, as the same threats to insecurity will be in place and could even intensify further. In conclusion, the establishment of stability in Sudan, and by implication, security throughout the wider region, is indeed the responsibility of Sudan's political leaders, but also requires pragmatic partnership, leadership, and strategic coordination among key influential states, such as those represented here, to commit the political resolve necessary to ensure we transition peacefully and with some degree of hope beyond 2011. I would like to underpin the recommendations already made that Russia and China stand to make a substantial difference in this regard and urge them to consider a more prominent role. Something extraordinary needs to happen fast. Thank you.
Наш следующий выступающий, господин Сергей Андреев.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Mr. Sergey Andreev from the UN mission in Sudan. I would like you to put on his presentation on the screen.
Микрофон.
Right, thank you. On the basis of the CPA benchmarks and risks, the presentation discusses the implementation, a set of scenarios, and looking at the future of the CPA implementation. There is a number of key CPA benchmarks required to be implemented between now and January 2011, and with accumulated delays, important contentious issues will now have to be dealt with in 2010. Thus, the next year is absolutely crucial for the CPA implementation, and I assume everyone in this room is quite familiar with this benchmark, so I don't think I should waste time on talking about the CPA benchmarks and just move to the scenarios which might be associated with the CPA implementation in the nearest future. Scenario one, which is called the troubled CPA implementation, and it's subdivided into a number of sort of sub-scenarios. Scenario 1A Delays accumulated around the referendum laws, border demarcation and election benchmarks, they all lead to election cancellations or to a unilateral declaration of independence by Southern Sudan. This first scenario would mean that we do not reach elections and the referendum is compromised. And here we have a risk grading, and the risk, as you all know, is a combination of impact and likelihood. And the level of risk associated with this scenario is medium. Likelihood is moderately likely, impact is critical. It would affect the entire country, particularly the extended current border line between north and south. It will be the main flashpoint. And as of October 2009 and onwards, with a gradual increase of likelihood and impact. In this scenario, a deadlock over census results at north-south border demarcation, on the basis of which electoral constituencies are delineated, as well as referendum laws would result in a delay of elections with the CPA parties remain unable to reach an agreement on referendum laws. Ultimately, the referenda would be delayed. Any delay in the implementation of the CPA benchmarks, which would considerably jeopardize the referendum calendar, could lead to strong reactions by the SPLM and, in the worst case, to a unilateral declaration of independence by Southern Sudan. In terms of operations, voters' registration would have to take place before the next rainy season, which starts in June 2010. If it's done during the next dry season, which is September-November 2010, it's almost certain that holding the referendum on January the 1st, 2011 would not be feasible for purely technical reasons. Regarding the elections, CPA parties would almost certainly consider agreeing on a cancellation of elections in order to avoid a major stalemate of the scenario of possible unilateral declaration of independence. A cancellation of elections would mean that popular consultations could not be held in southern Kordofan and Blue Nile. This would put the SPLM leadership of these two states in a very difficult position. Localized violent reactions of deceived communities would be very likely. The following assumptions are behind this scenario. At the moment, both parties favor the resolution of disagreements through negotiation, with the aim of avoiding a return to war or a secession of Southern Sudan, which would not be based on negotiated terms agreed to by both parties. This is illustrated by the handling of the RBA crisis and RBA arbitration, as well as by renewed partnership in Southern Kordofan. However, the time factor is expected to become increasingly important and several crucial issues remain unresolved. Political impact. With this scenario, there is a possibility of unilateral declaration of independence leading to violent reaction of unsatisfied regions in northern Sudan, this is Darfur and the three protocol areas, and oil revenues transfers to southern Sudan stopped. In case of elections in popular consultations cancellation, SPLM leadership crisis in southern Kordofan and Blue Nile would be quite possible. Security impact. In case of a unilateral declaration of independence by Southern Sudan, increased insecurity would be very likely, with the extended common borderline area being the main flashpoint. Similarly, we could see the reactivation or mobilization of wartime militias and former other armed groups. In case of halted oil revenues transfers to Southern Sudan, the latter could react by disturbing oil production in the areas it controls. As a possible result, tensions between oil police and GIU, which stands for Joint Integrated Units, SAF and SPLA components, would likely increase, possibly leading to violence. Serious command and control issues with all Southern Sudan security forces would be likely in the context of a financial crisis caused by halted oil revenue transfers. And this also applies to Southern forces still present in the three protocol areas. military intervention of SAF or SPLA seeking to demarcate the common border line through de facto military control of various strategic areas would be also quite likely. And now we move to the sort of second sub-scenario within still scenario one, which is 1B, and it's post-election disorder following successful elections operations and the possibility of jeopardizing the referendum. This scenario would mean that we reach elections, but the referendum is compromised by elections-related violence. And the risks here is assessed as high, likelihood is likely, impacts from severe to critical. It would affect the extended common borderline area as main flashpoint, with southern Sudan and Darfur as secondary areas, lower risk than the common borderline area, during the post-election period from April 2010 and onwards. In the case of this scenario, low-scale election-related violence would be likely at the intercommunal level in most regions of Sudan. Violence could be related to rejection of election results by supporters of either one of the two CPA parties or supporters of opposition parties. And as the recent international history bears witness, the rejection of election results very often can be used as an attempt for regime change. And the likelihood of this eventuality in Sudan is assessed as low, but it's still a possibility. In the three protocol areas, an NCP victory would be very likely to trigger a violent response from SPLM, or rather SPLM supporters. In such a case, rapid intervention conflict de-escalation would be essential to ensure that post-election disorder remains localized, and in the case of southern Sudan, to ensure that conflicts do not escalate, creating an environment in which the referendum cannot be held. The following assumptions are behind this scenario. Both parties' interest would be to control violence, contain it, and avoid conflict escalation. They have a strong interest in keeping the current power balance in the national and southern government, possibly achieved by an NCP-SPLM election deal. That is, the SPLM helps or supports the NCP, allowing it to stay in power, while the NCP assures SPLM a satisfying power share in the government of national unity, which would in return put the SPLM in a favorable position during both the pre- and post-referendum periods. This could be a prelude to scenario 2B. However, it could also lead to the, and I'm going to talk about it slightly later, however, it could also lead to the rejection of election results by opposition parties as well as Darfur movements, particularly if they are not included in such a bilateral agreement on power sharing. In case of ongoing disagreement on the referendum laws and post-referendum modalities, localized violence could be used to create an environment non-conducive to the organization of the referendum. Here is the political impact.
Mr. Andreev, you've been speaking for 12 minutes now, and you're still in scenario 1B, and we're 7 minutes past the time when the session was to be adjourned. Can I ask you to briefly summarize it, because we have one more speaker.
Right, then I'll go directly to scenario two. I'll skip the security impact. Okay, scenario two is basically post-referendum disorder, and scenario 2A is post-referendum disorder in case of unity. And the, in this case, we cannot talk about risk because the impact on the CPA is irrelevant in that case because it's basically post-CPA period, but the likelihood is very likely. And it's quite clear what are the problems associated with this possible eventuality. And then the scenario 2B, it's again falls into post-referendum disorder main category, and scenario 2B will be post-referendum disorder in case of secession with post-referendum arrangements. Because even if the post-referendum arrangements are made and are in place, they can be still quite unsatisfied and quite significant segments of the southern Sudanese communities, which may resort to violence and all other kinds of disorder for reasons which I don't have time to discuss in more details. So that basically concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you for your understanding.
And our last speaker today is Mr. Sergei Seryogych from the Institute of the Middle East. Distinguished Mr. Chairman, distinguished participants and colleagues, I would try to be brief and at the same time I would try to explain as precisely as possible my viewpoint of what can happen to my mind in Sudan with respect to the problem of referendum in 2011. Because answers to this question, as we can see from the previous speeches, can be found through a very detailed analysis of the processes related with implementation of CPA. And I would like to put this question in a bit different way, because the 2011 problem is not only a question whether the South will resort to secession or not. It is an opportunity for the whole country to make a qualitative transition to a completely different level of its development. It is a chance to put an end to the catch-22 of Sudan, which is dictatorship transformed into democracy, then transformed into a nightmare and dictatorship again. As I understand, in the modern Sudanese history, there are five main things that generate such a situation in the country. Number one is underdeveloped country or a lack of developed infrastructure, both social and economic, which results in constant conflicts between the regions and the center. The center, in this case, has to resort to military dictatorship in order to curb the violence and civil unrest. Number two, reason is availability of mono economy. It used to be cotton in the past, now it is oil. The country's income depends solely on the crude oil. Therefore, you see the whole tactics and strategy of the development of the country, which is based on making maximum profits, super profits from the oil sector. Very difficult ethnic structure of the population, which is fragmented with conflicting groups, Muslims, Christians, Arabs, Africans, and so on. Poverty is very high in the country. It's up to 80% of the population of Sudan that lives in extreme misery. Plus, external forces constantly interfering in Darfur conflict. It's first of all Chad and France behind it, while oil transportation security should also be ensured. For this, the development of social and economic infrastructure is important in the areas where oil is being produced and transported. Due to this, we can achieve loyalty of the locals because they will not be afraid of losing their jobs and so on. There is another option which used to be actively used and is still actively used. It is a military operation focused on expelling the population from the district, and the problem of local population is not discussed and is not solved in any way. unless we can consider expelling the population by force as a solution. In any case, all this results in new conflicts which consume new oil returns. And as you remember, the South and North war was yielding more than 70 to 80% of the budget of the country. Now, military and political rather than social and economic methods are top priority on the agenda. We think there are a number of reasons. Number one, military and political method is a very well tested and very efficient method. One of other priorities is investment into the national economy. And we know that if we simply give money to the government will simply steal it. Now in Khartoum, there are a few truly qualified engineers and project experts to be able to consume the money, even if it is invested. All this means that Sudan has no chance at all to cure these problems. But does that really mean that there is no other choice than resorting to the dictatorship? Of course not. This conference is a very good proof of the fact that the majority of the Sudanese department is trying to implement these solutions in order to solve not only 50 years of struggle. And I think that the Southern Sudan problem, to my particular mind, seems that the assistance to Sudan in its current efforts is crucial, answering possible remarks of those who are against this step, the ones who think that it may result in increasing separatism in the region. I would say that such a step will make it possible to concentrate Southern Sudan activities. The Southern Sudan minister will be able to accumulate considerable funds and use them elsewhere. I would like to mention that all the modern history of Sudan is the history of keeping the Southern Sudan. But the question is that due to this approach, one should go ahead with reconstruction of social and economic infrastructure. And if the South votes for cessation, for peaceful cessation, provided an agreement on the oil deposits is reached, then the government will concentrate funds in another region of Sudan, which we know that you don't have to be armed to reach your goals. So I have to hope that this will help us avoid any dramatic scenarios. And now, finally, I would like to feature the following scenarios. Number one, general national election and referendum in 2010 will result in a reasonable settlement of outstanding issues by Juba and Khartoum. This will enable both countries to become very good neighbors, which will definitely influence the situation in the other regions and, first of all, in Darfur. Number two scenario, choice of 2010, even with the fact that the election has started, but if the referendum was postponed technically. In this situation, I guess both the South and the North will do their best to have the referendum happen, and they are going to focus their efforts to keep this issue in the political plane without it becoming a military action. Another scenario, both Khartoum and Juba can blame each other for undermining the elections process. The elections do not take place. Initially, both forces start fighting with each other, and as a result, this can turn into a fully-fledged conflict or a civil war, a third civil war. This civil war can result in complete split up of the current Sudan because it will blow up Darfur, because it will be used as a second front by the parties. And finally, to my mind, the last scenario, which seems to be the least probable, and I think that we will either deal with scenario number one, where everything will be a success, or number two, where referendum will take place not in 2011, but later. But again, the chances that the Sudan will get the green light, will get a pass to future which will be stable, I think this is them. These are the two most probable scenarios. Thank you for your attention. Thank you, and I would like to thank all the speakers of the second session for very interesting speeches. I would like to thank the audience for its patience and for apologizing us for a 20 minutes delay in the morning and the delay in the evening as well. I'm the one to blame for this, and I wish you all success tomorrow. And last phrase my thanks to the interpreters for a very competent assistance throughout the day. Thank you. See you tomorrow.